This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on August 11th, 2010. And tonight we are going to talk to Drew Sellers and Rob Reynolds about a new project of theirs called The New Project. That's N-U. So welcome to the show, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
So why don't you guys just spend a minute or so talking about your background and where you guys come from?
So my background is coding, I guess. Been doing it for a while. Lots of open source stuff. That's been a big passion to me for quite a while. And so always looking for ways to give back to the community and work work at a boring bank at the moment, trying to make it as exciting as possible.
All right. My background, just a programmer. I really love what I do. Found programming kind of by accident. Had a crappy computer and got to fix it. And then I naturally shifted over to programming because it was more interesting. So
the new project falls into this bucket of package management systems, except it's one for the .NET platform, which has been sorely lacking. So it's kind of a topic near and dear to my heart, one that I've been complaining about for a while. And these guys decided to actually do something about it. So why don't you guys talk a little bit about why you took this on?
Mostly because there isn't anything in .NET, right? So I think it's been 2008 at the first alt.NET conference. A group of us were lamenting this fact that, you know, we had been dabbling in Ruby and the Jim's experience was just so phenomenal, but .NET itself didn't have anything. And we had several different ideas at the time, whether it was, should we use Jim's? Should we make our own? You know, what's the protocol? What's the standard? There was a million questions, really. So we kept thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And I think this represents really the third or fourth take at trying to implement this. The reason that we ultimately decided to go with the Ruby Gems product was because I'm working on a simple Ruby port of the Mass Transit open source project that I have. It was just thinking around with it, and I kind of got frustrated with Ruby, and I stopped to say, well, what's it going to take to make a gem for this? So I just put one together, and it only took like 5 minutes. And in the process, I just kind of found myself dumbstruck and was like, why didn't I do this earlier? And so we put it together, tried it out. And I mean, about two days, I think I had something functional running off of the Ruby Gems website.
So for people that aren't familiar with Gems and what packaging is and kind of are used to, I don't know, maybe more like MSIs or, you know, installers or whatever. I mean, can you give the short speech on what's so awesome about package management?
Well, we all do it, right? It's just how explicit are we making it? Whether you're choosing to put your code into projects, you know, because that's ultimately the beginning of all project management is separating your one solution into multiple projects. Now, when everything is in one solution, things stay fairly easy. If you've either worked with a shared library that maybe you've written or somebody else has written, or if you worked in an enterprise where there's some shared libraries that you don't necessarily get to own, you've more than likely run into the problem of some kind of version dysfunction where things aren't really kind of the way that you would like to see them set up, specifically around which version is referencing which version. So you can imagine in the open source world where there isn't any central organizing body, that there's no centralizing governance, everybody, you know, for the most part, tends to run around like they live in an asylum, right? So what package managers try to do is put some structure around how do you make your code available. Typically, that's done using the term package and declaring some set of metadata so that when you pull it in, because this is the other feature that they tend to provide, is the ability to go get the packages. When you pull it in, that everything is kind of lined up the way that you want. This is not a new concept, really. It's probably quite new to the .NET community, more so than it is anything else. So if you've worked with Ubuntu, you know, this is your apt-get. There's another one called Yum for another Linux distro. You know, like I said, if you've worked for Ruby, it's Gems. There's Python ones, Perl, you have CPAN. So it's really odd that we don't have one. So it's about time we did.
Yep.
So what's the experience for somebody using Nu? I mean, what do they start with? What do they do? What do they see?
Well, basically, they start with just reaching out and grabbing Ruby to get that installed. And then, you know, basically your interface is a command line. I mean, all you got to do is, you know, gem install new. And then from there, the world is open. What do you want? You know, do you want Fluent Hibernate? That's new install Fluent Hibernate. And then that's going to bring down Fluent Hibernate. It's going to bring down InHibernate. It's going to bring down Castle, you know, all the bits that you need and the correct versions and everything automatically gets brought to your local lib folder.
And so you guys built this on Ruby, which to some people might seem like a, you know, a heavy dependency to take. Can you talk a little bit about why you did that, what you got out of doing that, and you know, has there been any sort of pushback on that decision?
Sure. You know, we decided Ruby, I mean, the gems concept was there, it was proven out. We wanted to, you know, basically bootstrap and see if, you know, this could work for the .NET community. And so far we've seen a pretty good, you know, amount of people showing up and saying, yeah, this is awesome. With that, we've also had people saying, hey, you guys really shouldn't be on the Ruby Gems server. You really should get your own. So we've been working on that. I mean, we were right on in the beginning. We even talked to Nick Quaranto. I think that's his name. So his last name. He runs the RubyGems.org site. So
ultimately, it's about productivity, right?
Thank you, Drew.
The Ruby Gems was already done. All I had, you know, it was just one of those things where, okay, so all it's really doing is packaging up files. In this case, it was .rbs, but why can't it be .dlls? And it can. So I figured out where they were in the gem cache, started copying them into my project, following my conventions, I guess, if you will. So the biggest thing is just it was there. It was done. I could use it, and now you can too.
So what does new do that is more than just what gems does?
Gems will bring it down to your local cache folder, right? So you can do gem install all day long, and you're going to get it down to your local computer. You're just not going to get it that last mile, which is to bring it over from there to your actual application. And that's where new comes in. And with that, we've started adding features into new so that you could just do new install instead of gem install and then new install. So you could just type new install, I don't know, Roundhouse, and that brings it over to your local lib folder. So pretty good stuff.
And then those are all on a central repository. Like when you type new install in Hibernate or something, I mean, there's a few things. Like one, it needs to know where to go even look up in Hibernate, and then it needs to know, then it's going to get all the dependencies and figure out what it needs, right? So there's a central registry?
Yes. Central registry that's up. Right now it's on rubygems.org. Like I said, we're migrating off to our own server, and we're hoping to have that done sometime in the near future.
And then everything as far as getting the dependencies and kind of the package specifics figured out, like what versions are needed with what, that kind of thing, that's all just manual that you went through and figured that out?
Right. And then that would lay basically with the open source developer that would actually be bringing in these things. If I was the guy that was doing in Hibernate, I would already know what my dependencies are, and I would be filling out my gem spec with those dependencies, and as I upgraded those things like Castle, I would go ahead and update my gem spec as well. And that way, when I do push out the package, basically when other people go to use it, they're going to get, you know, the right gem and then all of the other gems that are dependencies for that one.
So you mentioned gem spec. For those who don't know, gem spec is, if I get this right, a description of what's in that gem file. Is that correct?
Yes. It's the specification for what's in the gem file. It helps actually build up the actual gem itself.
And what does that look like? Like, how hard is it for people to create these things?
It's frighteningly simple. There's just a few questions in there, and all you have to do is fill them out, and then, you know, it's going to ask where are your files, and you tell it where the files are, and what are your dependencies, and it's just, you know, spec.add dependency, and then the name of the dependency and the version. Frighteningly simple.
And like most things in Ruby, instead of configuring in XML or some other language, you're just configuring in a Ruby file, right?
Right, in Ruby.
So normally, like if you go and download the InHibernate package, it's got its dependencies, or not, sorry, not package, like the InHibernate zip file, the distribution. It's got dependencies in its distribution already for, you know, Castle or whatever. For the new model, would that be split out into its own gem, and then in Hibernate would just reference that gem, or would it all still be packaged together?
So you'd package them all separately. So each dependency is its own gem, right? And so castle.core is different than castle.dynamicproxy2. And I know they're starting to merge those together, but at the version that's out there right now released, those are two different gems because they're two different version things. But what you get basically, you get all these different folders, right? So you'd have a folder for castle.core, you'd have a folder for castle.dynamic-proxy, you'd have a folder for in Hibernate, and you'd have a folder for Fluent in Hibernate. And each of those are just going to contain the bits that are relevant to that particular product. And so when you do the referencing in your application, you're actually bringing all that back together. So in the folder structure, they live separately. But back in the Visual Studio, when you're adding your references, you're putting all those pieces back together. And so there's another product out there that Killaman, I think it's Michael Carter, has started. It's called New for VS, and that's pretty awesome. So for people that just want to live in Visual Studio and want to right-click, add new reference, and then they type Fluent Hibernate, it brings in Fluent Hibernate, and it automatically references everything else you need to be able to use Fluent Hibernate.
So if I've got, like, first I've gone through and installed in Hibernate, and then I install Fluent in Hibernate, so it's going to know not to overwrite my existing in Hibernate installation. Like, how are you going through and checking what's already installed, or was that what you're saying? Because they're in different, like, I know they're in different directories in the, you know, as far as what's been downloaded, but in my project, is it just, you know, it's not going to overwrite the existing stuff that's already there, right? It's just going to detect that it's already in place.
Well, so the idea is that you would be getting your structure back into a workable order for, like, new or for, you know, for gems and the idea of package management. So it's possible we would be overwriting some files, or we would be adding a new set of files to the folder. The idea being, if you're going to bring in and you're going to start using this, take a look at the stuff that's there and, you know, run your tests, you know, just run a new install and see how that affects your directories. I mean, you're going to see it with your source control changes.
You can prevent that by using the long name mode. The problem there is when you do want to upgrade, it's a bit of a hassle. Because the long name mode, it appends the version number onto the file folder. So if you ever did get a new version, you would see a new folder show up in your live folder. So we wouldn't overwrite anything. We wouldn't just force the upgrade on you. But then you'd have to go rip out all your references and re-add them, which can be a bit of a pain. That said, as we become more mature, we'll be checking before we copy things over so that we don't, you know, unnecessarily copy things. And also we'll be keeping track of metadata about what we have installed so that we know what's there already.
Okay, that makes sense.
So when these gems are being downloaded, they're being downloaded using this sort of standard gem protocols, right? Are they actually being downloaded to the system gem cache?
Uh-huh.
They are.
And so new is sort of almost like a bundler equivalent?
It's definitely much closer to bundler. Although I didn't know it at the time, I originally was just trying to mimic gems, but once I was looking at bundler, it's definitely much more closely aligned to that particular tool. So just a little context. Bundler, so in the gem world, there's a distinct difference between the way source code is distributed between Ruby and .NET that might be important to highlight, because it's one of the things that we kind of struggle with. So in the Ruby world, they distribute the actual source because Ruby is a scripted language. It's not technically compiled, or at least not the way that we think of it. So they just bring down the source, and when you reference a gem, whereas we reference a DLL, they simply load up that folder that gem is in. So it's the same net effect, but it's a totally different process. And since it's in the local gem cache, and because they don't, because they're dynamically typed versus statically typed, you know, they don't need to have the actual reference at development time. They only need it at runtime. However, in the .NET world, we need things at development time so that we can run our compiler against the code. So we can't really have all of our DLLs in one central master place, mostly because, if nothing else, it's considered a .NET best practice to have your third-party libraries checked into source control. So that's where we copy things over into the project itself so that you can check things in. Now, Ruby has noticed this same particular problem, and they've had some solutions where they talk about freezing your references. I know that Rails did that early on, and Bundler kind of brings that concept to any Ruby project. And what it literally does is copy the gems from the local gem cache into your project, and then modifies your load path to look there first.
So the gem system itself, you know, has a whole bunch of options. Like you can install, you can request a specific version or greater than a specific version or the pre-release version. Is that stuff available when you're, you know, working through new?
So right now the push is really just to get our own server up. But and I say that just because we don't have a lot of those features yet. Once the server is up, at least I'll have some time to come back looking and to look at adding these features in. But my goal, my first goal at least, is to mimic all of the commands that Jim has. So that way we can have the same experience. So if you say new install in Hibernate version 2, then we're going to go get that version. It shouldn't be too difficult. Obviously, since Jim is written in Ruby, the source code is right there. So it's very easy for me to go grab their exact code and replicate. Now, with that, there's a couple of things that we'll probably end up adding for ourselves. But the other thing I was going to say is currently right now, the dash dash pre command is available, but you kind of have to follow something called semantic versioning. So this is a whole new topic. Semantic versioning, you can find more about this. I think it's simver.org. I think I put that in one of the links.
That's correct.
But this is a concept around how do you version source code. And this is something that we've been talking a lot about with, or Rob and I have been talking about quite a bit, trying to figure out how we're going to push the .NET open source community in this kind of general direction of how can we manage our source code a little bit better from a versioning perspective. And SimVer, or semantic versioning, seems to be a really good idea. And if you do embrace it and its concepts, then you will get the advantages that that Jim's offers as far as being able to get the beta bits from the Jim server. And Rob, if you want to talk a little bit about the semantic versioning concept.
So with semantic versioning, you have basically major, minor, and patch, right? And everything before 1.0 is just completely unstable and able to be changed like crazy. Once you go 1.0, you just start patching. And when you basically get a feature that's compatible, but it's a big enough feature, you can move the minor up. But once you hit an incompatibility with anything in 1.0, you got to go to 2.0. Basically, I think a lot of people do this concept. I just don't think a lot of them say this is semantic versioning, right?
So it's sort of a formalized policy about when you change this number versus that number versus the major number.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, you know, for me, it's always been a feeling, you know, in all the open source projects that I manage, it's always been, well, I feel like I'm on 0.2 now, and so I'm going to go ahead and mark it versus, I mean, you still got that feeling like, well, this is kind of a little bit more major, but it's not quite an incompatibility. So, yeah, I need to go ahead and bump that version number.
So was that, were you referencing then, that's semver.org?
Yes.
And interesting, I see that specification was written up by the co-founder at GitHub. It's I don't know.
Yes.
Interesting. Did you already say that? Maybe you did. is it, so then the workflow, like somebody wants to add on, you know, they've got their cool open source project, they want to get that support added in new, they would write up the gem spec for it and submit it to you, and then you would host that. Is that kind of the workflow for it? And then they come up with a new version and they send you a new gem spec.
Don't want them sending stuff to me. That's too much.
Yeah. So how does all this work then? I understand. You guys, you're running SharePoint and people just upload, right?
Yep.
SharePoint.
no, it's actually, so right now you have to still use the gem command line tool. But it's literally gem build and then your gem spec file. And that'll give you a .gem, which is basically a tarball. And then you say gem push whatever your chosen gem name is. And if no one's claimed it, it pushes it right on up to the server.
Right, of course. Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
So how do you know that I'm pushing up the right binary? Or how do you know that I own the binary that I'm pushing up?
I don't. It's basically, we're back, just like GitHub. Just like GitHub, it's all about what is the community saying. If you put up a bad gem, do you think anybody's going to talk about it?
Well, so if Scott's just feeling evil, he can go up and start pushing a bunch of bad gems and Hibernate and everything and just cause chaos, right? Is there any kind of...
Sure, but that's when you get administrators.
Or insert a gem that emails database server IPs and passwords to.
And you could download bad open source software that can wipe your hard drive.
Yeah, but you get the source.
Sure. And you, so the
that,
trick
that,
here
that,
is...
So the point I'm making here is not just, you know, bust your balls. It's that this whole package management system has a whole ream of security behind it. Like, you don't just submit something to a Debian repository. You don't just say, you know, without it being checked, without signing and whatnot. And so I was wondering what kind of plans you guys had in the future for verifying the stuff that's getting put up there. Because what it sounds like is, in theory, I could grab RhinoMox and submit it, you know, push it up as my own if Oren hasn't already and no one's claimed it. Or if something new comes out, say there's some new project on CodePlex, I could in theory push Iron Ruby up and claim it as my own right now if no one has already pushed up a gem, right?
You are in one theory. Correct. So it's not even in theory, it's in reality.
Right. It's in reality.
So here's the trick, right? You push up Rhinomox, you put some bad things in there, someone reports it. Invariably, whoever is running the gem server is going to be alerted to it in one way or another. And they're just going to go yank your code down. And ultimately, they could even assign that name back over to Oren since he is clearly the owner.
So that's
So that's great, but damage has been done.
Sure, you are right. I have no defense, and I also have zero plans to do any checking.
You got rubygems.org. It's been up for a while, so maybe they've had the same issue and they've dealt with it. Or maybe they don't have these kind of issues.
So I guess my cautionary tale would be GitHub probably has lawyers somewhere that could possibly defend them against such things without having to incur personal expense. So you guys may want to be careful about that.
Hey, man, use it at your own risk.
Yeah.
Well, that's another question. Is there terms of use in a service for the site yet? Or when you get the server up, do you plan on having some boilerplate up there for it?
I think it's definitely a possibility. I mean, I'm not going to rule it out. It wasn't really something we were thinking about. We were just going to carry whatever the disclaimer was for, you know, Ruby Gems. It's a different skin.
But the idea, I mean, there is tracking. So like when I push something up, it's tracked to me and then you could theoretically.
Well, you being random email address.
Correct.
Or username or whatever you pick, yeah.
I wonder if there's a way to like check, you know, like you can check a CRC or something on a download. I wonder if there's a way to check, you know, like I could verify something. I could see who uploaded it before I install it. I mean, I guess it's all spoofed.
Well, and that's what a lot of the Linux open source projects do. They throw a hash up there so that when you download the binary, you can check the hash that they're publishing against. You know, what you actually downloaded and make sure that the two match. So you know that the hash was generated against the binary that's built from the original source that's uploaded by the developer. So you can say, okay, so the binary matches, you know, the hash published. So I know that I've got a binary that was built from the source that they've published. So when I look at the source, I know that's the source for this binary. It's not for a different version. There's no, you know, it's not a, the binary doesn't have a malware in it, but I can look through, or if it does have malware in it, you can see it in the source because it's public inside of it. And I think GitHub has something like, well, no, GitHub publishes the check-in hashes, but it doesn't do hashes against downloads. I don't like package downloads, like, well, the zip files or archives. I don't think, not too many of them do. Apt-get does, I think. Portage does. I'm not sure about eggs, and that's all I can.
So you guys are talking about standing up your own Ruby Gems server. What is involved in that? Is that an easy thing to do? Is that a difficult thing to do? Could I put my own, you know, in my company, put up a Ruby Gems server that new can talk
to? You sure could. It's not terribly well documented, but hopefully that'll be solved after I'm done. The biggest problem for me has just been learning Linux while I'm trying to set this thing up. So it does use a couple of components. So it uses the latest and greatest pre-alpha beta bits of Ruby on Rails. So you'll have to get the pre of that. And then you just stand up Redis, you stand up Postgres, Apache, typically Passenger, which is an extension to Apache to run Ruby sites. You can also run Enterprise Ruby if you would like. Set up the website, run Rake to get the database set up, and I think you're pretty much ready to go. So it's taken me a couple of days. Most of the time it's been just, you know, learning Unix idioms or Linux idioms. And I think I'm down to just figuring out why the email won't work. And as soon as I get that one solved, then I think we're done, other than making it not look like rubygems.org.
That send mail config is black magic. I don't think anyone understands.
So you mentioned, you know, setting it up and running on Linux. And I mean, in general, we've been talking the whole time about Ruby proper. I read somewhere about support for Iron Ruby. Is there Iron Ruby support for it, or is it something where you're pretty much going to want to go with standard Ruby?
You can basically do either. I mean, if your company's preference is not to have Ruby, but they're fine with Iron Ruby, then by all means, Iron Ruby. But a lot of people say it works great. There's even been like things submitted to GemCutter and Ruby Gems patches for the universal.net what is it called, platform. So we've been talking about whether we should use that or not. What's that?
Web platform installer?
That's the platform for Iron Ruby. It's called universal-.net, and it was a patch submitted Will Green, possibly. Yeah, Drew's writing it out. But that's how they delineate an Iron Ruby package up on a gem server from a regular Ruby. But yeah, Iron Ruby works just as well as Ruby. And it's really just your preference. Which one do you want to use?
Cool.
So what are some of the packages you guys have out there already available for people to use?
Oh, gosh. There's quite a few already. We have a list of them. If you go out to our Google group, it's groups.google.com/new-net. There's a list of packages, a link available from that front page. That's going to take you off to the wiki. This is probably not up to date. There's people putting them up left and right, so we're trying to keep up. And it's community editable, so if you put up a package, you could just throw your name up here. Rob versus Bill, the Gem Hack Fest. Yeah, a while back, Bill Simser and I decided we were going to see who could get the most gems up. And he was starting with two, and I was starting with 13. And I was like, well, maybe we should go by releases, because then I have 49 and you have two. It's really not a competition in that we're trying to get them up as fast and you know, having crap up there. But it's really about just kind of getting other people involved, you know, just to see, you know, how easy this is.
So you guys sort of bootstrapped the initial set. Have you been then pulling in the you know, the project owners and getting them to incorporate it into their build process or whatever makes sense?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we have up on there is it talks about, you know, you're going to build a gem for somebody else. Here's the things you need to consider. And one of those things is, you know, after you've done it or while you're doing it, even you should be talking to the people that, you know, own that project. And then if they don't want to maintain it, then sure, you can maintain it, but get on their mailing list so you can see when they have their releases. If they want to maintain it, then work with them and help them get it back into their build or whatever. And it's really easy to transfer owners. That's one of the greatest thing about gems is you can add owners really easily.
I'm just looking at this list here, and there's quite a bit of stuff here. Some of the big open source .NET projects, Ninject, NUnit, Fluent in Hibernate, and Hibernate, Lucene.
Well, yeah, there's only like 12 .NET open source projects, isn't
there? I think this might be all of them, in fact.
Were any of them especially difficult?
You know, I actually took it upon myself to try to figure out how difficult it would be to handle, you know, the dependency issue. A lot of people talk about Castle versus in Hibernate and how much fun that can be. So I did Castle Core, Dynamic Proxy, Windsor, and then went to in Hibernate and Fluent in Hibernate. You know, it turned out to be somewhat simple. It was just a little bit time consuming, just going through every release and figuring out what its dependencies are, you know, kind of getting them into the proper gem spec, you know, folder structure, and then building the gems and pushing them.
I would say one of the interesting things that's come up is how we handle things like NUnit, which is both a tool, but it also has a client library aspect. And how do you go about treating that? Because there are some people treat it differently. For instance, I put the entire NUnit zip into my source control folder. So that way I have everything and I can just pull it down from source on any machine and run my build. Although a lot of people just install NUnit and only check in the NUnit.framework.dll. So we've had some very interesting discussions around how to treat something like that. One of the other ones that's been interesting is the bigger the scope of the project. So if you get into something like an in-service bus or a mass transit, where they're really building on top of, you know, 16 other tools, it can get pretty interesting, especially when you start to look at the lower level dependencies. So mass transit may want, you know, something down here, but another project may want that same project, but at a different version. We don't have a solution for that yet, but it's something we do plan to help the developer in solving. But so figuring out how we're going to handle that has been interesting discussions. The other ones that, thank you, Rob, that has been interesting to talk about is what do we want to do about the contrib projects, where things kind of fly in and out at relatively breakneck speeds, and they don't necessarily have solid release structures associated with them, can be interesting as well. So right now we've decided just to kind of punt on the NH contrib stuff for a while, or those kinds of projects, and really try to focus on the core use projects. One of the side effects of working with this that we haven't really talked about that's been thought-provoking, I guess, at least, is that the Ruby GemSpec has a concept of a bin directory, which is things that you want to execute. You can put executables in there. And what it does is any file that it finds in there, it builds a Ruby shim file in your path so that you can actually execute it on your command line. And we've been playing around with what does that look like. But I tell you what, it makes for a phenomenal developer experience. Rob, you want to talk a little bit about Roundhouse in that regards?
Sure. Roundhouse is a database migrations utility. It's aimed to be very close or as close as .NET can get to the migrations framework that comes with Ruby. You could type gem install Roundhouse, and that's going to pull down all of the bits to your machine. If you wanted to bring it over to your local live directory, you could do that as well with new install Roundhouse, and that would bring over just, you know, the console. But once you have Roundhouse, it comes over as an rh.exe executable, and it's simple as typing, you know, rh/d, and then your database name, and then /f for files, and then just a dot if you don't have any, and that's all it takes to create a database. And the future, or where we're going with it right now, it supports Oracle, SQL Server, and Access, unfortunately. But I had to put that in for work. In the future, it's going to hit just about everything that InHibernate supports, because Roundhouse is going to use all of InHibernate.
So do you have the ability to host your gem files somewhere other than the upcoming new gem server? Like if I was an enterprise, could I set up a local source?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so just my dev team, here's your source. Okay.
Absolutely. What we understand is that you can have multiple gem servers, and it can just walk straight up the list until it finds that gem.
Gem has a concept of a server or a source so that you can specify it, and you can add servers and sources to that so that you could actually add these to your gem install so that it would go get them by default. One of the things that we're trying to do with new is not, or as much as we can, not necessarily pollute the Ruby experience. So while people are working with .NET, they're using the new, we also want to make sure to try to keep the Ruby experience clean as well. So new, one of the things that it does is delegate down to the gem executables, the gem command line, and it pretty much always, it will always append on the default gem server for the .NET DLLs. I'm not sure how that's going to play out completely yet, but that's kind of the goal. That way, we can try to keep the two different worlds as separate as possible.
We were talking about how applications could use the bin directory, and I didn't quite get to that point with Roundhouse. When you install it, then from anywhere on any command line, you could type a command, or you know, and then you could run these applications from anywhere. And that's kind of the concept we started exploring with Roundhouse.
So when I was experimenting with new, I noticed that I installed, you know, Fluid and Hibernate, and I noticed that the package that was installed looked like pretty much just the assemblies, you know, and not necessarily other stuff that might be packaged in the distribution, like, you know, help files and sample code and all that sort of stuff. Is that kind of the intent, that you keep it bare bones, or do you think people will end up putting more stuff in there also?
There's a docs folder, and so samples and help files and that kind of stuff could go into the docs folder. We don't bring those over by default. We just bring over what's in the live folder. So, I mean, you got a docs folder, you got a live folder, and you got a bin folder. Those are the conventions for Ruby. There could be conventions we could add to add more folders. I mean, it's really just whatever you put into the gem spec.
So that brings up kind of a good question as well, which is what goes in these darn things. So right now, the real goal is if we could just get the DLLs in there, then that's going to solve probably 80% of our problem. Now, can we use this tool to also distribute documentation and sample code or anything else of that nature? Then yes, you can of course do that. There's no real convention around it yet. There's no real support for it yet, other than just shove it in the live folder and it'll get copied over. So this is also where you can put the licenses as well. What else can you do? We've talked about you can put executables in there. So I think Rob has a trick as far as what it takes to actually get it to execute the .NET code, but it's definitely doable and we've documented it, so we can certainly help you out if that's something that you're interested in. You can put your client libraries in there. So if you're a server product, let's say you're the thing that gets talked about a lot is RavenDB. So in there, if you just put the client libraries in there, if they want the server, then maybe they can still go to the website, pull down the server, and get that installed, because there's a little more to be asked there rather than just give me some DLL so that I can program against it. Another topic that's we talked about on the list today, which I think is an interesting concept as well, is the meta package, which is something that a lot of the other packaging systems have done for a while. A metapackage is a package that just contains dependencies on other packages. Specifically, think of it as, let's go back to InUnit. So InUnit may be by itself just the metapackage, but it may also have a dependency on InUnit console and InUnit UI and InUnit framework. So if you just install the one, you'd actually get all of those things. It's definitely an interesting concept that's been brought up on the list. And it reminded me that Rails, Ruby on Rails, that gem itself is a metapackage itself. So if you go look at its gem spec there, I don't believe you'll see anything in the live folders at all. You'll see a folder for the bin, and then everything else is a dependency on like Active Support or Active Record, et cetera. Hopefully that data about the data helped you meet your meta challenge.
So there's been another attempt at this packaging stuff that came up, seemed like about the same time you guys were doing your stuff, that the OpenWrap project. Have you guys looked at that at all? Have you talked with
just one? I'm pretty sure there's more than one, although some of them are less well known.
Yes, at least a couple that have sprung into being in the very recent past.
Yeah, so there's been quite a few. So in my mind, right, I'm first, of course, because I started talking about this in my head a ways back, but I'm sure somebody beat me. They just haven't met me yet. On top of that, the next one that I really saw was Horn or HornGit. And although it's a little different story, because what it's trying to do is build everything from source to kind of solve the build everything against trunk, which solves a different problem. But the user adoption didn't really end up working out. And I think trying to build everything was definitely, when talking to Paul, it just seemed like it was quite the challenge. And trying to go through and think through everything about how you would do it. One of the things I wish that could have come out of that, even though the project is now for the most part considered dead, was a greater convention around how do you start a build in any project. While I have the microphone, I'd like to advocate that every open source project and every project in general should have a file called build.bat or build.sh if you're really mono focused, that I can run, and that's my entry point into the rest of the build system. So hey, that's just me, and that's my two cents on that. But the Horn guys were really trying to work through not only getting everything together, but then also trying to build everything. What I took from that was building is really hard, so I'm not going to do it. There's been another approach called Bricks, which I did not really look at. There's I think there's actually somebody out there got one called NGEMS that I haven't really looked much into. And then probably the one that's the most well known is going to be OpenWrap. OpenWrap, written by Sebastian over there in England, is definitely taking a very interesting approach. I haven't looked at it extensively. The last couple of times that I've pinged him, I was having some difficulties trying to understand what was going on. If you get a chance to see his talks on this particular thing, I encourage you to go see them. And if nothing else, shoot me your feedback and tell me what you're liking about it. But definitely go check that out. Again, it's OpenWrap, and it's written by a fine man named Sebastian, who also writes Open Rasta.
Smart guy.
I was saying in the chat, the first few times I heard people say HornGit, I just sounded like they were saying PornGit, as in P-O-R-N. And then I also thought it was funny when I first looked up new project, the first answer on Google was not the actual new project. It actually was also Naughty Naked Women. So I guess it's pretty much impossible to come up with, a name that's not, I mean, there's good and bad things about every name, but was I guess new originally came from Nubular or whatever, reading the I don't know.
Originally, yeah, it came from InGems. InGems.
I tend to suck at naming things for their Google juice. that just seems to be my affliction. So yeah, it did start from Nubular. I'm trying to remember what the whole story was. We were sitting in the bar at the MVP Summit, the hotel. And we were just, we need to do this again. It was like, okay, the triumphant return of the idea for the second time. And we started going through names because that's fun to do while you're sitting around drinking. And, it was like, okay, it's .net. Maybe we're going to do something with the fact that it's a net and we're going to call them casts, or because you cast a net. Or maybe it's going to be castanets because that's like a musical instrument. At some point, through many of these variations and probably a few shots, we came to Nubular. And we decided that would be really fun. And then that makes for, if you shorten it down to just NU, that makes for a nice command line name.
Yeah, that's definitely nice. Just NU space, whatever. I mean, it's brief.
I wonder what new install new does.
A recursiveness that you shall never escape from. And just for that, I'm banning you from the mailing list. Nah. We know exactly what it's going to do. It's going to attempt to install itself. So if you have, if there's an update out there, it'd probably update it. Otherwise, it's not going to do anything. Exciting answer, I know.
So the big question, of course, it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter what OpenWrap and new HornGet and anything else does once Microsoft comes out with their own. If Microsoft comes out with a package management, and you got to believe that they've at least thought about it, maybe they've run into god-awful hurdles or, you know, or something, or maybe they just can't find a way to do it politically or get it done. So what happens to all these projects when there's an official, you know, sanctioned way from Redmond to do it? Do you try to interop with it? Do you just say you can use it or you can use ours? It is the same thing.
I think that's the million-dollar question right now is, you know, we've been so long without package management. Is this something that Microsoft is looking at? Is it something that they're trying to solve? We don't know. Is it something that we think we're going to try to work with if they do? Once again, you know, can't predict the future, so not something that you know, we're sure about yet.
I mean, the theory was that, you know, you get through MSIs and the GAC originally. So you need to worry about versioning. You put stuff in the GAC and refer to the version you need, right?
I think I just threw up my mouth.
You get a new MSI. So that's proven to be a little problematic, so...
So
maybe that is their solution. Maybe MSIs and GAC is their package, you know, product.
To go back to your question about Microsoft, you know what? If they come out with something and it's awesome, then we're going to interop with it and we're going to use it, right? But until they do, it's definitely hard to pontificate about. And ultimately, is their solution going to work on Mono? I don't know. Our solution will. Our solution does. So will we be competitors to them if they come out with something? Heck yeah, we're going to be competitors to them. Are we going to be supportive of what they do? If what they do is awesome, then heck yeah, we're going to be supporters of what they do. And for me, it's just all about bringing the awesome. Mm-hmm. And if they're not bringing it, I plan to.
I think there's always a lot of, I mean, like, I'm just thinking of, like, in Hibernate and Entity Framework. I mean, there's definitely room for both. And Hibernate adds a lot of things that Entity Framework doesn't, pushes it forward. And then also, in a way, probably by people looking... I don't know. There's probably people that use and Hibernate that wouldn't have if there wasn't Entity Framework, because they, you know, they kind of get interested in it because there's an official ORM, and then they run into something and they say, oh, I can do this, and you know what I mean? I can do more, or I can work differently with an Hibernate. So I mean, again, depending on if and what it, you know, theoretically did, you know, I mean, having more than one of anything is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right on.
Microsoft came out with their own unit testing framework, but it's not like people have flocked to that. So, I mean, I think.
Well, and, you know, in the enterprise, there are places where everything's MS tests. I've worked with things where it's just, that's it, you know. But again, I think that's something where people that wouldn't have thought to unit test before, then they work with MS test in their shop, and then they eventually run into, you know, something that'll do more for them, or, you know, whatever. I don't know. That's my theory. I have no statistics to back that up, but it's my theory.
Well, that's a good point, though, because really the thing that the .NET, the open source community needs, and I say this mostly talking about myself, is that we need a sense of maturity in how we're going to package our software. I'm definitely the worst at it. I just don't even think about it half the time. I've run off of trunk things and not even thought about, well, what if I just actually use the real release? I tend to just run off trunk on a lot of my open source projects. That's been fine when it's just me. But when I come to bring things into an enterprise, it makes a lot more sense to use a real released version. It's just easier to support and it's easier to talk about. So if it does nothing else, right, if having new and having OpenWrap, And if Microsoft brings out, you know, MSI 2.0, whatever, right? If they bring that out, but as long as it brings the conversation of how are you going to package your things, that's the overall win, is if we start thinking about how do we release and how do we manage our projects and our source code and do releases that make sense. You know, following the standards of don't, if you have a breaking change, that's a major version number increment. If you just have additional features that are substantial, that's a minor version increment. If you're just fixing some things, that's a patch upgrade. again, if we can go back to following the rules that semantic version lays out or something similar to it, right, then we all win no matter what the deployment story is.
Do you guys have a roadmap for how you see this thing developing over the next, you know, few months or a year?
I think it changes so much right now that, you know, we're trying to get a roadmap out there right now, just our feature list. You know, people are saying, hey, I'd like to have this. So we start throwing them up on UTrack, utrack.codebetter.com. We are talking about putting up a roadmap. We're trying to get a little more stable first because things are, like I said, changing.
So in the immediate, what you can look to expect is getting the server up and then one by one matching the gem command line. So that way we can have the full experience. And once those things are done, at that point, I mean, my work will be spent towards bringing greater enhancements. Now, if somebody else wants to come in and bring the awesome, then definitely feel free to fork it and submit a pull request. Please do that.
So how many people do you have involved? I mean, both in development of new and then also in just packaging.
So there's myself and Rob, obviously. Bill Simpson has been doing quite a bit of work, not just on helping with packages, but has been pushing the story forward and helping us understand things and has been doing some additional kind of graphics legwork for us for the server and things. The other big one is going to be the guy that's doing new for VS. And that thing's freaking awesome. So new for VS, right? It's going to bring a plugin inside of Visual Studio to help with the add reference concept. And there's been a bunch of other people for sure. Oh, and then I should definitely give, again, a big shout out to Nick Q, Q-Rush on Twitter for all of his help with setting up the Gem Cutter server. I got a chance to meet him when he was in Kansas City, and he was able to, you know, he said, hey, if you want it, try it. And he's made the full Ruby Gems website available as this thing called Gem Cutter. So if you go to github.com/RubyGems/GemCutter, there's the site. So a big shout out to him, and also a big shout out to the Ruby community in general for letting us use their server while we try to figure out how this is going to work for us.
How was that like? Was there any kind of like, I don't know, were they pretty open to it? Did it take some convincing?
They were super supportive. Nick is a former .NET programmer that left .NET to go work on Ruby, and he actually got a big kick out of it that the .NET community was going to use basically something that he's working on.
Oh, cool.
So he was super supportive. I think he spent probably 3 or 4 hours with me. Just, you know, okay, Drew, you got to remember Linux, the backslashes go, you know, the folders go the other way, or Drew, don't forget to lock down your blah, blah, or, you know. So he's definitely been super helpful in that particular regard with helping me figure out how to get everything compiled and learning some Linuxisms and things like that. So, no, he's super supportive. He's, you know, says it's no rush for us to get off. You know, it's as long as once it becomes something that we're going to do, you know, please find your own home. But kind of until you're on your own feet, you know, here's a couch you can crash on.
So you'd mentioned new for VS, and I had noticed that's on Visual Studio Gallery. As I don't know if it installs as an extension, but it looks like other than you need Ruby or Iron Ruby and Ruby Gems, then it's not. So basically, you go through the standard new install process, and then you install new for Visual Studio. Is that the idea?
Yep. You still got to get, you know, Ruby, and you got to get new, and then after you do that, I mean, you're good to go, and it does basically install as an extension.
Okay, cool.
So I think I'm out of questions. You guys, anybody else have anything they want to ask?
No.
Kay Scott?
He's officially dead. Calling hotel security.
He doesn't even have the time zone.
And I'm having pie.
You're having pie?
I do have, so I have one other thing that I'd like to say as a shout-outy kind of thing. So here, just a second, let me get a little space and I'll say it.
Give them space.
And you can figure out, you can splice this wherever. I'm just basically going to tell people to please contact their open source project and tell them to get a gem. So
do you want this to be an official, we have backing music for the Pimp Your Stuff segment.
Yeah.
So if you'd like that, we can officially transition into the Pimp Your Stuff section, and then you'll have some backing music.
I have no idea what I'm lost, but I can do that.
That'd be a yes, Drew. Yes, Drew.
Okay, yes, that's what I want. Yes, please.
Okay, Pimp Your Stuff.
Do you have an open source project? Do you use open source projects? Would you like them to be easier to get? I know that I would. If you do, please point your open source project developers to this new thing called new. It's spelled with an N-U, and it will help you get your open source projects faster. Okay, I'm done.
You know what would have made this cooler? An umlaut. For Sam.
We're going to need you to do that again.
An umlaut. I mean, I don't know how to type those, man.
Heavy metal umlaut.
Say it with the umlaut like and without the umlaut and see which sounds cooler. Nuh.
Nuh. Don't forget to install the nit.
Maybe that just brings up another thing. What if you called it meh? Just M-E-H. Is there a project named meh? That'd be cool.
Microsoft Error Handler.
There's Elma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's close.
Yeah, okay.
Managed Extensibility Handler. There we go. Meh. We've got it.
Can we get it close to another drug like meth?
Is it cool?
Meh. If we call it Pat.
Call it Moo. Hmm. Can't think of an acronym for that, though.
We call it a nine ball.
There we go.
There we go. I like crack.
Get your rocks.
How about naked ladies?
Naked.
Yet again, impossible to search for.
That's a synonym. That's
so much fun.
Man,
maybe call
it's
it New China.
Mass Transit now has the third link in Google.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
Just be careful. Us open source people, we don't like your product. You know, we'll just overtake your Google space.
Great, yeah, I'm never going to get a subway in New York. Thanks.
Yep. Just get the Mass Transit phone app. So, if you have an iPhone.
There's a phone app for that?
Yep. So, Chris was using Mass Transit while he was taking Mass Transit, while he was working Mass Transit, listening to Mass Transit while in Boston.
That's just gay.
Oh, that's right. There is the .new extension.
Yes, there is. I saw that a long time ago.
Yeah, so what if you were like new-new?
New-new.
Is that like a moo-moo?
I don't know.
Is that like yes? Yes, yes. New-new.
All right, we seem to be coming toward a wrap here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's interesting to talk about. I really don't think that there is. I mean, we've definitely talked through the versioning stuff. We've talked about, you know, some of the security stuff that you need to be aware of. You know, what's the command line experience like? How easy is it to gem things up? I mean, that definitely sounds about right. So,
are you going to work on the errors message so they aren't so craptacular?
The first three
not,
are
not the, for new for gems. Are you going to fix the gems one? Doesn't just tell me, you know, five steps into a dependency, could not build lib for obscure reasons.
Yeah, ideally that's going to get better, right? Oh, man, that is so the website that Rob needs.
Basically.
.new.
Or how about blueshirt.new?
Yeah, but basically this is so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rob doesn't wear anything but a blue shirt.
Absolutely.
I don't know why he doesn't work at Microsoft already. He'd fit right in.
You lost it.
Actually, if you want on the... did we take up enough space for the pimp your stuff? Because I'm sure Rob would love to pimp some roundhouse or some uppercut or some drop kick or something else violent.
Or top shelf.
Yeah, we can pimp top.
No, I mean, you've earned it. I mean, if you want to pimp stuff, that's what it's about.
I don't think I can pimp the way Drew just did.
Rob, why don't you pimp something? Brown chicken, brown cow.
I'm going to pass. I'm too tired to pimp anything.
All right. Well, there you go. You had a shot. Sorry. You suck.
I could pimp it some other time.
You guys should definitely have Rob talk about Roundhouse sometime. The stuff that he's got going on is actually, I think it's pretty cool. It's certainly making work a lot easier.
No way, man. Database is dead. We don't deal with database.
Do you have audit? Do you hate audit?
We have no audit.
Do you have Sarbanes-Oxley?
At one point.
We have four layers of audit. Let me tell you how awesome it is. And you know what we do?
Four bosses, Bob.
We punch them in the junk. Junk punch audit.
We haven't built that app yet.
FDA levels of auditing. That was it.
So that's what the Roundhouse is about, making the audits.
It's about a lot of things.
Did we talk? You mentioned it earlier. I mean, do you want to talk briefly about it?
Sure. Yeah. Just Rob, do some jumping jacks or something.
Jumping jack flash.
Boom.
Sorry. Roundhouse is it's basically database management. It's also versioning your database. Like a lot of us talk about versioning your applications, and you know, maybe I'm going to version it by source control, or maybe I'm going to use semantic versioning or whatever. But nobody really talks about how you version your database. And so Roundhouse comes in and says, you know, why don't you do it the same way you do your code? And so basically, or essentially, when you set up all your stuff to get ready to migrate, another thing you include is, you know, this is how I'm going to version it. And so it handles all of the mundane stuff like, you know, I only want this file to run once, or this is a stored proc, so it should run, you know, whenever it changes. And these are permissions. So these permissions need to run every time. It does all that for you automatically. And it's got a lot of goodness in that kind of stuff. Plus, it makes Audit happy.
And that's over at code.google.com/p/roundhouse. Is that the best place to find it?
Yes. The shortcut for that is projectroundhouse.org.
Ah.
Take you there.
Okay. Should we take this thing out, basically? All right. Thanks a lot, fellas, for coming on. Really excited about this project, and I will definitely be using it. So check it out, folks. And join us next time for another episode of Vertico.
I cut all the pauses out. Don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you're basically filtered working.
No, I don't. I'm going to copy those all to the end of it and just say.
At the end of the day, it is what it is, as long as you bring your A game.
So it's basically a part of your A game? Is that basically your game?
Basically.
I tried to give you some synonyms, essentially, and you know, what else was there?
Absolutely,
every
essentially.
A-minus game if we're on a curve?
Basically.
Basically. Basically. Basically.
Basically.